You're listening to the ESO Network, your station for all things geek.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to this week's episode of Monster Attack, the podcast dedicated to old monster movies. And we have got an extremely special episode this week for you because we are going to be talking about the 100th anniversary of F.W. Murnau's Nosferatu Symphony of Horror. But to make it even more special, I should say, I hope this makes it special. Mark Maddox is back with us again. Hello, Mark. Yeah. You've been gone for a long time here. How's it going? Say hello. He's not saying hello. He's okay. Mark is being goofy. But also okay. He's going to talk. Okay, now you're going to talk. Go ahead. Talk.
All right. Hi, everybody. Good to be on the show. Such a fantastic film we're going to be talking about today. A super masterpiece. And getting great background information from our other guest.
Yes, a very special guest. A first time here on Monster Attack, and I hope not the last time. The great grandnephew of Bram Stoker himself, Dacre Stoker. Dacre, welcome to the podcast. We've been talking about this for a long time. We finally found an opportunity to get you on here.
Yeah, we certainly have. And thank you. It's good to be here with you and Mark Maddox, both guys. We have chatted about these types of topics at different conventions over the last couple of years. And now what a great time with the 100th anniversary of Nosferatu, the 125th of Dracula, to get the team together and chat about all these cool things.
Now, before we dive into the film, because, again, this film is one of my all-time favorites. You and Mark are a part of this month's – I think it's this month's issue of Scream Magazine where you – wrote a very extensive article about some of the background surrounding and some of the, I would say, sort of the myths and rumors of things that happened between the Stoker estate and Nosferatu, and sort of set the record straight. I mean, I found a lot of it really illuminating because I'd been hearing these rumors for years as to the estate fighting Nosferatu and that sort of thing. So, Dacre, can you tell us a little bit about what led up to the discoveries that you've made concerning that?
Well, yeah, this is a really complex issue. And I'm so glad that Scream Magazine asked me to write about it. I brought my son into the fold here because not only is he a PhD in English literature, but much like I've picked up the mantle, you know, as far as the Stoker family is concerned, one of my goals is to encourage my son, because he's obviously in the right field, to continue these studies, to get him involved. And this was really an interesting case for us to delve into. And it is complicated. And one of the problems that I found, and I would like to hear what Mark thinks at a certain point about this, and you too, Jim, is there are tons of rumors that float around. And with all the research that I've done about Bram Stoker and his life and his writing of Dracula, I also find that rumors are easy to come by, incomplete evidence are easy to come by. Even biographers who do, you know, good work are only they're only able to get certain amounts of information because newspaper articles, letters, and things are very slow to get digitized in major archives because that's an expensive proposition. So the information, it might exist, and I know darn well, and I know this for a fact, there are boxes of letters in a certain museum in England that's associated with Shakespeare, because Bram was the manager of Sir Henry Irving, famous actor, but they're there. They haven't been digitized, and there's gold in them, their boxes. So, you know, when biographers get to work, they're only as good as what information they can find and how good they're digging. In this case, with the Nosferatu case, I'm seeing all of these sort of suppositions that people come up with. Oh, Florence Stoker was motivated because of this, or she did this. You know, when Murnau approached her, she wouldn't sell the rights. Well, there is nothing found anywhere. And I've got a friend in Germany, a German film historian. For 2 years, this guy's been digging everywhere he can to try to find the court records, and nothing exists that he could find. I mean, he has been extensive. Right. He hasn't been able to find Prana's point of view in this whole case. And so there is nothing that says they approached Mrs. Stoker and offered X number of dollars. So I then went to where I could, which is our family side and all the papers that exist. And there are actually two great-grandsons who are the grandsons of Bram's son, Noel, the son of Florence, who they have lots of books and papers and have loaned me information over time. They've got nothing, no recollection, no papers that say that the family was ever approached by Prana Films for the rights. And I just sort of fast forward. Luckily, the British Museum somehow was handed over from the Incorporated Society of Authors, Independent Society of Authors in England, who represented Florence Stoker in this case. She had to bully them to represent her, that all their correspondence between their German lawyer that they had to hire and this Incorporated Society of Authors and Florence, those exist. And they're sitting in the British Museum, and there's like 56 letters or something like that. And yeah. I've been able to read them all. David Scull, who wrote Hollywood Gothic, has been able to read them all. So he's got that perspective as well. But it gives us one half of the story, Jim. Only one half, but you have to then take some leaps of faith when you look at this and read a little bit between the lines. So that's where I started, and that's where most of my information has come from.
You know, one thing I've noticed over the years in film studies is that sometimes you find something that people have set in stone, and it turns out just not to be true.
Yeah.
There are certain stories and certain things that people said, and you go back and you, I mean, I won't go into any specifics to irritate anybody, but there have been times I've seen photographs in films where somebody said, well, this then created this character down the road, and there's no connector between the two. It just started off as a gee, that reminds me of that. That goes on for about a decade. And then the next decade is maybe it was a connective piece. And then by the third decade or fourth decade, it's a fact. Yep. You know? Yep. And so when I'm sitting there eating breakfast with Dacre, over in Pensacola, and he corrects me on it, I'm like, no, I'm not one of those people that goes, no, I know what I'm talking about. I was like, wow, that's fascinating. Thank you for setting the record straight, because it's always that court of law sort of thing. Can you absolutely say that that was the truth? And so many things are just nebulous in that respect.
Drives
me nuts.
No, I've been here, and it, you know, again, that rumor I'd heard for years, that, you know, that Florence Stoker had fought Nosferatu and you know, caused all kinds of legal, and, you know, and the more you heard the rumors, the worse they got. So when I read your article, Dacre, it really opened my eyes up to, okay, here are the actual facts. One, there was no correspondence at all. There's nothing to suggest that Prana Films even approached Florence about the rights whatsoever. She even claimed it, they never approached her or whatever. And then it sheds just a whole new light on the whole story. Because she got quite a bad knock for so many years.
Did. And I think what would be interesting to discuss at the moment, because you gentlemen may know more than I would about, obviously this was the beginning of a film when it comes to horror. But what I did was to look back at in their history, and you know, with the absence of absolute fact is what we three guys are talking about now. Yeah. You've got to look at as if this is sort of a CSI Nosferatu,
right? Right. Yeah.
You know, uncovering certain bits and pieces of information.
Right.
And one of the bits that I found was that this was not the first copyright infringement by Murnau and Prana Films. They actually did a film in 1920 called Der Jonsakoff, The Head of Janus, which was a knockoff of The Strange Case of Jekyll and Hyde.
Right.
So it's like, this is like a tendency, you know, this is a show is their tendency that there must be an interesting attitude. And this is what my son and I sort of debated, is how can we find what the prevailing attitude was at Prana to make them feel like they could not only go after, you know, Stoker, but Robert Louis Stevenson.
Yeah. And, well, would copyright infringement at that time not have been as enforced? Like nowadays, you know, Walt Disney, you know, if you do something there, man, they've got 5,000 lawyers all over you. And yet, you know, it makes me wonder, back then, maybe it was still loose. Maybe at the time it wasn't, they didn't have people, maybe because they were in a different country. Maybe they felt there was a little bit of distance between them.
I think it's a case where the technology gets far ahead of the legalities, and we're seeing it now in the digital age. And it doesn't surprise me at all. This is a, you know, back then, this is a new medium. We weren't even in the sound era yet, but the visual medium of silent films was still pretty new, and they had not worked these issues out. And it doesn't surprise me at all, seeing what's going on right now with some of the digital issues that are coming up in the industry, that just go get the thing, change some names, you know, make it a little different, and who's going to say anything? I totally believe that's probably what happened. I can't prove it, but just based on, you know, how these things seem to sort of develop over years as the technology changes, I think.
Jim, that's all we've got to go on, really, because there isn't the hard proof. So you have to look at, you know, what was happening. Well, we know this was the, you know, really the beginning of book to film adaptation.
Absolutely. I mean,
heck, you know, book to stage adaptation hadn't been going all that long. And Bram Stoker made the provision to make sure that he protected the dramatic rights, the stage rights of Dracula, to protect those, something to leave to his wife. He probably had no idea, you know, that he needed to do anything else. And who knows what you have to do internationally. At the moment, that was just, you know, what he had knowledge of, what he had the ability to protect at the time. And these guys who were, you know, groundbreaking filmmakers, were like, as Mark said, they probably didn't even consider, they probably weren't bad people. It's just that they thought, oh, this is artistic expressionism. These are great books, and, you know, no big deal.
When did he die, Bram Stoker?
1912.
Yeah. See, the film industry wasn't.
No, it wasn't. Yeah, it was still
what it was going to turn into. Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah. I could see that. I will throw one out there. If you watch the Japanese version of King Kong versus Godzilla, Godzilla wins. Remember that one? And if you watch the American version, King Kong wins, which people said that in books for years. And it's like, that isn't even that old. That was written in the 1970s and 80s when the movie came out in like 1962 or 63. And it's like, man, there was evidence laying all over the place that was a load of crap. but you see what I'm saying, Dacre? I mean, it's like, even in that short truncated amount of time, it's like, things can get, lies can become fact, unfortunately, very easily,
very quickly.
Yeah.
And nowadays with podcasts and with blogs and things that, you know, with all due respect, Jim, you know, there is less filtration, you know, than in established newspapers where you've got all these different editors that
absolutely
hammer somebody down because they're worried about being sued for something.
Yeah.
We've got a a lot of great free speech, which of course brings up great creativity. It puts guys like us three together to jawbone about this, but that's the case. You know, when you look at blog posts and you look at things in newspapers that now people get away with, they tend to proliferate all these different sort of half-truths. And as Mark said, if nobody challenges it and they get away with it, it quickly becomes a truth.
Yeah.
And then it gets onto a panel somewhere at Monsterama or Anticon, and now it's God's truth, and nobody challenges it.
That's right. And we've run into it on other films, Mark. Yeah. I know Mark and I have he's heard one and I've heard another, and then we've had to go do some research as to find out.
And even if in the end you can find out who's really got the true answer.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I've heard arguments between two historians that they end up hating each other.
That's right.
Charlton Heston wrote this in one book, and they said, I never read that any place in my life. And it's, oh my gosh. And then they're like, you know, okay, guys, we'll get out the swords and go at it. But it's weird. I mean, that's why I never say I'm a historian, even though I deal visually with a lot of historians, like watching films over and over and over again and trying to find out what I can to make a painting special. When people ask me some historical question about film, I mean, it's like, yes, I know, you know, what year Dracula came out, but for most stuff, I said, I don't know. I'm not going to go down that. Even if I think I'm right, I say, don't quote me on it, you know? And that's what a lot of people should be doing. The historians need to be the people that need to be cited, not, that's you right. know, Tom, Dick, and Harry.
Well, that gives us a good jump off into the actual movie itself. Now that we've got a little bit of perspective, and I think, you know, I'm really glad we had a chance to talk about this a little bit, because this is one of the, you know, with the various restorations that have come out recently with Nosferatu in the last 15, 20 years. I remember 1979 when Herzog made his remake, they got talking about this all over again. This rumor's been around for almost a century now, since the very beginning of, I guess the official release date for this film was March, I believe, March of 1922, when it had its premiere in Switzerland, I think originally, and then went to Berlin.
So, yeah, that's one of the cool things that a lot of people don't get, is that it was sent out in advance of the planned right. premiere in Berlin, and so to try to reel in these other copies that were out in, I think, at least four countries, Jim, was impossible. And as the Incorporated Society of Authors were looking at, okay, Mrs. Stoker, we're going to try to help you on this case. It's going to cost us a lot of money. And when they finally prevailed, and the court and the German court said, well, you know, you're going to have to pay money. And they realized that Piranha was bankrupt, no money. So it was they that decided to have to have the films destroyed. Not Mrs. Stoker said, well, you must destroy them.
Right.
She was this pawn. But then they realized, wait a sec, you've got at least four other films out there. That means different cases in each country you're going to have to go and pursue.
Right.
So this was not just the one singular sort of attack, let's just say, to protect her rights in one country. It would have been many more. And they simply decided, fold up the tent. This is not going to happen. Let's just do what we can with the one in Berlin. And just to kind of try to finish off this piece, what drove me crazy, because I know you want to get into film, is that here she was trying to do what was right.
Yeah.
And this was 1922 when it came out. 24, 25, she was working to get the stage play, the adaptation, the rights to that sold. Hamilton Dean, John Balderston started the stage plays. Bela Lugosi played in it. It became a huge hit. And then you press the fast forward button to 1930, when Universal is looking at getting the stage rights and turning them both into film rights, and still a couple of copies of Nosferatu were floating around, pirated in the US, and Florence Stoker is having a conniption fit that I've tried to put this thing, I've done everything I can with all my resources to put this thing to bed, and will this devalue or even derail my potential
right.
to sell the rights legitimately to Universal, because they will, why the heck pay money for the rights to this thing if there's a pirated version floating around?
That's one thing I've heard before. If you, even if you are trying, if the perception is you let something slide in a courtroom, it becomes very difficult. Somebody goes, well, they mean that that's still out there. She let that out there and they didn't pay for it. Why should we?
So as it turned out, Universal ended up not only having to buy that copy of Nosferatu floating around the US, and my research showed that, you know, people are saying, well, it's not only to get it off the streets. They wanted a close look at it to see, you know, what worked, what didn't work for their own research. Yeah. And then, you know, the end of the story is that, you know, she got paid well for it. Dean and Balderston got a piece of it. She got paid well. And, you know, there's a happy ending, because in a way, it's a really good happy ending, because she didn't destroy what's an incredible piece of work that we're going to chat about.
Yeah.
And I'll tell you one more interesting thing that I actually found out after I finished writing the article. And that is a friend of mine came down to visit me in South Carolina from Boston. He's a lawyer. And he said, you know, I went to Northwestern. In the law school there, they still teach to this day the Nosferatu copyright infringement case as a example of the lawyer going beyond his reach in choosing the option to destroy the film rather than have some sort of restitution down the road paid, because it oversteps the bounds of a court to destroy art. Isn't that you're an artist, you know? It was like that should not happen. And
never
again, today it's still taught in law schools.
You know what's interesting too? It's a little similar to the Spencer Tracy thing. Now, once again, you know, you might get a historian that says this isn't true, but for a long time it was said that Spencer Tracy really wanted to, I don't know if he wanted to destroy, but he wanted to get rid of the Frederick March version of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde so that his version was considered the official version or something. I don't know, you know, Dacre, I don't know if that's ever taken you down that path with that film or not. It might not be in your wheelhouse, mixing metaphors. But the thing is, I mean, the Frederick March version is this masterpiece, and he wanted to do his version. So it was like he wanted to run right over it. And for the longest time, I didn't see Dr. Jekyll and that version of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, I think, until like the 80s or 90s.
No, that's right. There was about a 20-year period that just wasn't shown anywhere.
All we saw was photographs, and yet we never saw the film. Now, to sit there and dump it on Spencer Tracy could be a load of crap, but I had heard that, and it is interesting that I didn't see it for a very long time, you know, in comparison to the other classic horror films.
So who knows? Yeah, I was going to say that's one of those rumors that's been around for years.
In a court of law, I cannot tell you.
But I am thankful that through a series of events, which I find it's almost like God given, that somehow a print survived, a good print, a relatively good print survived that a lot of these restorations were able to come from. I think it was one that was like sitting on a shelf for 50 years and nobody even knew it was there, with all the original subtitles in it, because over the years they had lost bits and pieces of it, and then there were some unauthorized additions that were put together from bits and pieces of film that were found. And I feel lucky that the last couple of times I've seen this film, it's been from the definitive print that Murnau made with you know, based, well, they recut the title cards so they were a little easier to read when they restored the picture, but we're seeing pretty much the product that he wanted when he first produced this film, or directed and produced this film in 1922. And it is just an incredible masterpiece of expressionism.
I've seen different cards on different versions. I remember when VHS was new, you'd go in the bookstore and they'd have these public domain films, Nosferatu being one of them. And they would say the name Dracula in the cards.
Yeah.
And then other times you'd have Graf Orlok, or, you know.
Well, the US versions changed the card to Dracula. some of those early ones, some of those really bad copies. Yeah. You know, and I've got a couple of collections that survived in my collection of Nosferatu that have that in there. It's, you know, they're really, really hard to see and read, and then that sort of thing. But the new restoration, I think the last one that came out, I think about 15 years ago, where they all come tinted, just beautifully, beautifully restored. And the ones that you can see now streaming and also on Blu-ray.
Is that the Kino restoration? Yeah, I've got that one. It's pretty magnificent.
It's incredible.
You know? It's so good. It's almost bad, because there's a scene where Nosferatu is walking toward the house. He's got his coffin tucked under his arm, and they show a big old close up of him. You can see the tape holding his pointed ear on, and you can see the skull cap. You can see where it's just like, I mean, the tape is coming up and everything. And I'm like, ooh, maybe they shouldn't have restored that well, you know, a little too good of a job, you know? It's sort of like watching classic Star Trek now in Blu-ray and everything. And you see this, and you see that the sets are made out of wood. You can see where there's fresh cuts where Mr. Spock's dropping in an information disk. And it's like, ooh, maybe you should have just sort of maybe not restored that episode.
You can make it a little too high definition sometimes.
Yeah, yeah. But so, Dacre, what are your thoughts, your artistic thoughts as just a as a guy just watching the film? Give us some of your thoughts on the film.
Yeah, that's probably the way I look at it, because, you know, I have a hard time disassociating, you know, my God, they ripped this thing off. They should never have done this, blah, blah, blah. And so I pull that side of me away and say, okay, just chill out, relax. It's all done. Nothing you can do about it. Just enjoy the film. And I get one of the first things, Mark and Jim, that you know, sort of jumps out at me is, my God, this is pretty close to the book.
Yes.
You know, it's obviously without any verbalization, you get a lot of these scene changes that's quite similar to the epistolary style of the book. And that's what you get when you read it. You get these different, constantly flip the page, one person's perspective, another. And so you're trying to, as the viewer or the reader of the book, you're trying to make sense of what's going on. And that's the same thing that I got when I'm trying to just relax and watch this and sort of put the story together, which I like, because it makes you think a little bit, and the more you think, the more it gets into your head, you know, oh my God, what's going on with this guy? How's this affecting this other thing that I just saw? So to me, the composition of this movie is similar to the book that I really like it for that reason. Mm-hmm. Artistically, you know, the tone, you know, that kind of sepia tone is creepy.
Yes.
It's what I imagine being in these castles. And of course, I haven't been in the castle where this was filmed, but I've been into castles, many of them in Transylvania, that are connected to, you know, the 1400s, 1500s, to Vlad the Impaler. And some of them have been, unfortunately, so gussied up, you know, bright lights and things behind glass cases. It looks nothing like this, but others do have that feel. And I love that feel, guys. It makes me, you know, say, thank goodness we're not, you know, there are some good films these days that have ton of CGI and all kinds of great effects, but I like watching this because of its, you know, that back to the basics.
It's real.
Gnarly, yellowish gray. Right. Feeling that I just get when I'm watching this thing, especially, you know, you turn the lights down low and you know you got a glass of wine and you just enjoy it for what it is.
Dacre, you've spent a great part of your life hunting for the actual castle for Vlad the Impaler, or the castle that Bram based his novel on, and you've got a movie coming out soon about that. I loved the settings of this film, the starkness when you get into the town. After Orlok gets there, they're worried about the plague, but, you know, he's almost the plague. He's a physical ramification of the plague itself. And it's something that Herzog also did very well in the 79 remake. Yeah. It looked like the same setting.
The same salt.
Amazing. The same. They never changed over all those years.
What was that thing called? The salt factory or something like that? There's those buildings that are very pointed. I was in doing this cover for Scream. I wanted to put those buildings from him where he floats up in the boat holding the coffin under his arm.
Yeah.
I wanted to get that on the cover, but it made him, you had to back it too far away and it made him tiny. So I just took the street from the scene where the guys are walking with the coffins during the plague. Mm-hmm. But yeah, a lot of that, I just watched both the versions of Nosferatu, and the scene where the boat comes in the modern version, it's the same place.
It's identical.
It hasn't changed. You know, it's actually, I don't know. I really like that. I like that about it, that he used the same place.
Yeah. This time out, I watched the Herzog version about 2 months ago. And then I watched Nosferatu just, you know, this past week for the podcast. And I was just stunned at how close they matched up. They really did.
But this is what I know about the castle. Cause friends of mine in the Dracula Society in London who take mm-hmm. themselves very seriously about sort of factual things connected to Dracula and anything in that sphere, is this castle was called Orava Castle in Slovakia,
okay.
O-R-A-V-A. Names of those countries in that area, you know, change their names like Mark Maddox changes his drawers. You know, it's like unbelievable how quickly they change its wars and leaders.
I'll be back in a minute. I got to go change my drawers.
Yeah, please do.
There goes another country.
That really weird looking castle tip top that you see in one moment of film, doesn't that still exist? Isn't that still, you know,
if it's a Rava castle, I mean, that's what I was getting to. The guys from the Dracula Society went there just 2 years ago. So it's still there, and people go there because it's not only a really cool castle, but it's the site of the filming of Nosferatu.
But you said there were two castles used. Are both castles still in existence?
I understood, that there were two different castles that they had used.
I lived in Germany, man. When we lived, the people at the house across the street from us was centuries old. The walls were so thick. It's like, you know, we live in a country where things are, you know, practically paper mache in comparison to those houses. So it wouldn't shock me at all if both castles were completely intact, or as intact as they could be.
I pulled up something, Mark. Strahad, Strahad, Strahad Castle. Mm-hmm. I just quickly pulled it up on Google. Again, it's only Google, so we don't know if that's factual or not, but that's a lead that this CSI Nosferatu we should pursue a little bit later. But I want to touch on something that Jim mentioned just while we're talking castles for a moment, because so many people, you know, connect this film to Bram Stoker and the castles in general. So again, here's a chance to set records straight. Vlad the Impaler was a ruler in Wallachia. He was turned into a count in Transylvania, which is the neighboring province.
Right.
So when Vlad was the ruler of Wallachia, he did move around what we now know as Romania, Transylvania, Moldavia, and he hung out in different castles. When he was the ruler, he got to stay in different places, but he also rebuilt Ponari Castle as a fortress. And the one that always comes up is, did he live in Bran Castle? And that's the one that you see many images of. Mark has probably drawn this from time to time on different works of art. That castle is connected to Vlad very, very, in a very minor way, because it was right on the border of Wallachia and Transylvania. And the border crossing was where taxes were collected between people obviously coming and going and trading merchandise. And that's where Vlad needed to collect money to create an army to hold back the massive Ottoman Empire, which was pretty much coming across the Black Sea and all around him. So he was probably there from time to time, but he didn't rule there and live there. But Bram Stoker did see two images of that castle in two of the 26 books that were in the London Library that he had checked out over a period of time when he was doing his research on Dracula. And it's the only two castles that there were sketches of in those 26 books. So when, and imagine, Mark, you're an artist, you know, Bram was an amateur artist himself. He was a founding member of the Dublin Painting and Sketching Club. So I'm asking this question of you, Mark, while I explain what my famous great-granduncle did. Being that artist and being a writer, I am convinced when I read his description, and it's not a long one, of his fictional castle Dracula, it looks an awful lot like these two sketches that he saw in the book. I think he had to look at something, Mark, to then be able to describe it in writing.
Sure. It's a research or anything. I mean, you have to research to get a feel for it. Sometimes you have to get it to get the passion. I mean, heck, this morning I had to get look at pictures of rabbits, because I was doing a fake kids menu for a book cover, a restaurant. And I had to like submerge myself in flowers, grass, and I submerged myself in grass a lot, but, and rabbits, and just, you know, and just, and say, you know what, today's time to learn. I've had to, there's been instances where I've had to look up a specific camel from a specific region in Arabia where it's like, you got to get the right kind for that area or somebody's going to tell you, hey, you got it wrong. And it helps build the passion for what you're doing. So I think I completely believe that. Are those the ones that I saw on that 125th anniversary edition of Dracula? Are those the two?
Yeah, that I'm glad you asked that, because what I did, what I thought would be a very cool homage on this 125th, is on the front cover, use the castle in Scotland that Bram actually visited it when he was there while he was writing Dracula. And he was in this town 16 summers. That Slane's castle, there is no question when you read the description of Harker arriving into Transylvania, he goes to the front door. He's met there. There's no knocker, no chain to pull. The same thing in Slane's. He walks inside, makes his way through one corridor to an octagonal room. That is Slane's castle. So that's on the front cover. You open up the book and you see the sketch from the Charles Bonner book of Bran Castle. So that's why I wanted to combine those to create the 120th anniversary of Dracula book, which I also shoved in things that were edited out of the typescript as well.
And that's fascinating too, that like the description comes from a castle in Scotland, which everybody's, you know, jumping over to the mainland. And yet this one castle kind of is part of the setup. Do you ever take people over there? I know you've had tours that you do certain things. Have you ever taken people to that castle as well?
Well, funny you ask. It's planned, and I'm headed there May 20th for the 125th tour anniversary tour. We can't include. We were planning to make this an extensive tour and go off to Transylvania, but you know, with the Ukraine war going on, right next
that's
door,
be
refugees
tough.
Coming
yeah.
in.
Yeah,
it's just not a good it's not a good look to go into. Right. You know, enjoy yourself and hang out in hotels where they're housing refugees and eating food, you know, we're high on it. So it's like, but the crazy thing is, and I'll get to the actual question is, because Jim had asked, where did this actual, you know, the merger of the two castles we're talking about, Slane's Castle from Cruden Bay, Scotland, and Bran Castle from Brasov, 400 miles to the northeast, is right on the Moldavian Transylvanian border.
Wow.
And that's the location where, from Bram's notes, he left his lines of longitude and latitude, names of two rivers. They merged right here. In Dracula, he actually mentions the 47th parallel. It's where the band of heroes are chasing Dracula just before he manages to sneak into his castle. So nope, there is no castle up on top of this mountain. It is an extinct volcano, and that is critical because the original ending of Dracula, before it was edited out, had a volcanic eruption.
Yeah.
So his merged castle on a volcano. I've been there. I plan to take people there when the situation clears up. But for now, I'm headed off to Whitby, where Bram actually set chapters 6, 7, and 8 in the story. Very gothic, very cool vibe. And then on to Cruden Bay, Scotland, where he not only wrote Dracula, but two other books called The Mystery of the Sea and The Water's Mow. And he also was there, very sadly, in the end of his life. He'd had a stroke. He was suffering financially, and he wrote The Lair of the White Worm. If you've ever read that or seen Ken Russell's movie, it's kind of strange, but it was a work of a favor to his publisher. His publisher said, "Yeah, have you got one more left in you?" He'd lost his sight, his one eye. He was affected by the stroke, and he managed to stroke this one out.
Wow.
and that's why, you know, people say, "Oh, it's not his best work. It's all disconnected." Well, yeah, when you realize his physical and mental condition, you can understand why.
Yeah. I'm friends with Lizzie, Ken's wife, on Facebook and stuff. And I find the movie to be absolutely a joy. It's like Hammer's the Reptile on acid or something.
Yeah.
It's just so whack. Ken Russell can put energy into scenes that nobody else has. Now, I have not read the book, but I would like to read it sometime. Can I ask you a question, Dacre? We should be getting back to Nosferatu, but I got a question for you. Do you have like five favorite Dracula movies do you have, or do you deal with stuff like that? You go, no, I'm all into the research and I don't pick.
That's a good question.
I mean, I'd like to have Dacre's list of his five favorites, like the ones that he's going, ooh, got my popcorn ready and my beer, you know, well, and I'm.
I actually did that. I did it for a friend of mine who runs a website in England called Spooky Isles, which is all kinds of things, you know, paranormal and so on. And let me see if I can remember this, because I start with a little bit of a disclaimer. And look, we know this. There are periods of time where it's difficult to compare, which I love. I mean, I like Nosferatu, but then you move forward to the 1931 Todd Browning. I think that's great. Yeah, at the time, you know, that was cutting edge stuff. But I also like the Spanish version of that one too, even though I don't understand the Spanish language well, but the camera angles and the passion and some of that was great. The fact that there were some liberties taken in Todd Browning's with armadillos walking around the Transylvanian castle are a little strange, but hey, I get it. It's going to be otherworldly creatures and that's cool. Yeah. So those are big, but then, you know, I also like the 58 Dracula with Christopher Lee. We begin to see things that censors wouldn't allow, which is fangs and blood on the mouths.
Right.
And of course, you can't complain about seeing lots of nice cleavage, which shows up in those films. So that's also nice.
Right.
And then I jump forward also, you know, there is, I got to tell you that the 92 Coppola, I like it. I'm not exactly thrilled that they called it Bram Stoker's Dracula without going to the family, my cousins, to say, is this okay? But we, you know, you got to realize the situation. There was no legal precedent to have to ask them.
Yeah.
But the fact that they took liberties and created a story out of Jim Hart, the screenwriters, adapting the myth and turning it into romance, I'm okay with that. You know, it doesn't have to be the perfect faithful adaptation of the story, which, you know, really, except for the 1977 BBC Louis Jordan version, that's about as close as it comes, I think.
Yeah.
But it doesn't have to be super faithful to the novel to be a good film. So those are the biggies in my book, Mark.
Those are good ones. I like them all too. Yeah. I mean, well, like love, you know, I've watched every one of them so many times I can't count, you know. I mean, especially the 31 Dracula, Lugosi Dracula. Oh, yeah. I've seen that so many times. I mean, I've played it as many times as I've played my Sgt. Pepper album. I mean, it's just insane. I mean, there's sometimes I've actually let it run more than once in a day, and I'll even like let it run in the background while I'm painting or something, and that too. But man, that's a good list. Any thoughts on the Langella Dracula? Do you like that one at all?
I tell you what I really like about it. I put together a little compilation when John Browning and I did a panel at Monsterama, and it was like, who's your favorite actor that played Dracula? And so I figured out how to get film clips off of YouTube and put them onto the computer. And that ending of Frank Langella getting hooked with that in the ship, dragged up, right, Jim? And then the sun hits him, and every revolution.
It's a great scene.
It is so powerful. And when you consider also, and I don't know as much as you guys do about this, what sort of effects they had to work with at the time. That was cool.
It was all practical effects. Yeah, no CGI back then.
Yeah.
It was all
John Williams' score, when he's up there trying to get off of that hook score with the sun's burning him, John Williams and the orchestra are going nuts. I like the movie a lot myself too, but those are all great films. So I guess
he gets a nod, you know. He's one of the two guys that have played Dracula on stage in film well, which is kind of
neat. I remember when I remember in the mid-70s it was a huge thing to hear about a play in the National Magazine. Normally it was kind of, at the time, you'd hear about a play here and there, oh, here comes Annie, here comes the King and I, but to have Dracula being so popular that you were hearing about it in Florida, stuff going on in New York and in London and stuff like that, that's like, it's really, you know, had an impressive footprint.
It was huge. It was like what would happen when we had Phantom of the Opera. make its big splash on Broadway. I mean, it was. I mean, still, I remember when they announced the film being made. I mean, we were just chomping at the bit to see that film when it came out because of the hype it had gotten from the Broadway tour. And sure. I hate that I never got to see Langella perform it live. I would have liked to have seen the live show.
Yeah, I had a friend of mine in Washington see Martin Landau play him, which at first, at the time, I thought, that doesn't make much sense. But then after Ed Wood, I'd like, oh, man, I'd kill to have seen that.
Yeah.
They had a lot of great people play him. Jeremy Brett played him and Raul Julia played him.
Yeah.
So I guess we should kind of talk about Nosferatu. I'm sorry. I'm running you guys off in the wrong direction. I apologize for that.
Well, I'll take us in a different tangent because this really smacked me in the face a couple of days ago when I watched this movie. One last refresher before the podcast, the whole feel of after he gets to Wisteria, as a Wisteria, I believe it is the name of the city that they moved to, that's suffering from the plague and all that, seemed to be more powerful to me this time around. And the same with the Herzog version, because we're coming off a pandemic. I didn't realize how much that affected me watching this film. The starkness of the city, everybody all locked in behind closed doors, very few people out on the streets, if any at all. Virtually when Dracula's carrying his casket or coffin, I should say, back to his new home, there's nobody on the street at all. The whole starkness of it and the feel of it, and here we are, we're coming off a lockdown a year and a half ago or whatever. It sort of enhanced the film for me even more than what I loved from this film to begin with, because I've always loved German expressionism.
Yeah, I agree with you about the pandemic affecting it more when I was watching it this time. I mean, the people back from that time period had their own plagues, diseases and polio and all these kinds of things. And now we're coming out of it. Now it's a little more personal with us. And even watching the rats and Nosferatu is sort of like, yes, this is an infestation.
Yeah,
it's no different than what's going on inside your body. If you catch this bug and it starts to spread through you, and then they show the rats at certain levels, there's like a small pile and then there's this huge pile and they're pouring down the dock and all that. And it's a very creepy way to connect the two. And also it was his cloak. You know, it was like a cloak for him, because he could get away with this. Well, people are kicking off because of this plague. And it's like, well, that and Nosferatu's drinking their blood. But yeah, so.
Well, you've got also putting in perspective, we know what was causing it back then, the rats. And the research that I've done about vampire scares in general, just like in the U.S., Bram had in his notes this article about the tuberculosis outbreak in New England. People had no idea they didn't know germ theory. They didn't know how contagious TB was. And of course, plague and other diseases going through Europe in the medieval days. So the unknown was worse. Close the door, hide it. We have no idea what is causing this. If it's this guy with pointy ears walking around, or it's the rats, or it's the air, like the cholera epidemic that Bram's mother live through, is it the air? Is it the water? How is it contagious? That, Jim, to me, when you feel it ourselves, like we all have in this last 2 years of the pandemic, you can identify with what the filmmakers are trying to do. Yeah. Grab that feeling of vulnerability and the unknown. So you may as well just hide for your life and just don't let anything in, let alone, a rat or two.
And that's the point. I mean, when I first, I guess I was in college when I first saw Nosferatu, because it was very, very hard to find, and I think it was probably one of those bootlegs that was circulating in the United States. But I mean, when we would watch other films that dealt with this sort of thing, we never thought in our lifetime we would ever experience anything like that. No. It's like, oh, yeah, yeah, they had the plague then and all that stuff. And they had all these diseases and the anthrax breakout and all that. But we never, I think, I never dreamed I would ever experience that personally in my life. And until 2019. And then, boom, there it is.
Well, we had other things that we were afraid of that were happening. There was the bird flu, and there was the different things that scientists and people kind of kept an eye on. And when it popped its head up, they kind of, you know, started working on it right away. Here we are here after this. And, you know, what are we? Are we at a million gone now? I mean, how many people are gone? Are we
got to be awfully close?
Hundreds of thousands, because that number was climbing. But, you know, and so, yeah, were you right? You watch Nosferatu nowadays and it takes on a different meaning and not a pleasant one.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, and I don't want to belabor our own situation, but still, even in our case, we really don't know the overall effects, the long-term effects in our body.
No, we don't.
This COVID thing. And so you go back to that vulnerability in the movies. You know, people sort of thought, okay, you go to the dark side, you convert to a vampire. You know, what are you really getting into? You know, it sounds sexy and so on, but it certainly that was an initial kind of a good PR program. You know, hang out with Dracula and you'll be seeing all these women in see-through nightgowns. But, you know, what really goes on is does your body deteriorate? Do you there's no more reproduction going on. Does your hair grow? What's happening? It's really sort of it's grosser than what was left there. And that's what Nosferatu didn't really glamorize too much. It didn't make it a glamorous type effect. You know, that's
yeah. I mean, even like on the cover, when I was doing it, somebody commented on him looking over his shoulder thinking he's a big rat. He's a rat when he tiptoes into town. I mean, I was thinking about the other day, I was originally thinking about doing a side view of that where he's really kind of his legs are really up high and he's kind of prancing through the town holding this coffin. I thought, what the hell does that remind me of? I just in the middle of this podcast, I realized what it reminds me of, although after the fact, is the Grinch stealing a Christmas tree from the Chuck Jones cartoon. But the thing is, it's like really creepy. That guy is really skinny.
Yeah,
he's got those giant shoulders that they've put on him and everything, and his head is submerged into his neck. I mean, it's a very ghastly look. And I've always said, what's the scariest thing you could ever think of? And I said, a Nosferatu type face staring in your window at 2 o'clock in the morning. You wake up and look out your and there's a Nosferatu looking in at you. I would just die right there. Like, he wouldn't have a chance to bite me. I'd just be like, and that'd be it. Because it is such a horrific look. The coming up out of the coffin straight as a board.
Oh, that's wild.
I mean, just the way the hands are a certain length when he's looking at the picture, and he tells him that his wife's got a beautiful throat when he's looking at her photo. But then later, his like fingers are so long that they go down below his kneecaps when he's got them pressed against his thighs, and he walks into that room. The door opens up, and he just sort of walks in stiff as a board with those huge pointy ears and those two front teeth. It doesn't get much scarier than that.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's pretty horrific.
So I've got a question for you guys. Why do you think Murnau decided to implement the son killing the vampire rather than what Bram had written just to reduce his powers? Obviously, budget. It's a very dramatic ending, but what are your thoughts?
Budget. It was what happens in Bram Stoker. I mean, I remember the first time I saw Bram Stoker's Dracula, and they're chasing him, and there's guys falling off the cliffs on horseback, and there's the big knife sequence and all that. And it's like, oh my goodness. Whereas in Nosferatu, it was like, you know, we are in a country that's, you know, doesn't have a lot of money here. You know, it's like the Godzilla suit being made instead of the Ray Harryhausen style animation. They could afford to do a guy in a suit. So economy was part of it. But at the end, and then it also, the woman, you know, gets to be a hero. And there's a great Greek tragedy here where she dies saving not only her loved ones, but the rest of the town and things like that. And it worked. It was effective.
You know? And I think it's I think there's a lot of symbolism in there. I think Murnau wanted to bring it into the whole symbolic thing of, you know, we do as a society tend to think of the rays of the sun as being healing, as being sure. cleansing and that sort of thing. So you just take it to the next step where it just, it dissolves this infestation or whatever. Yeah. I mean, that's how I looked at it a little bit from an impressionistic point of view that, and it's funny that, you know, as kids, we all grew up thinking that was part of the vampire legend Germain, but here's where it started, guys. Right. I mean, it pretty much started with Bram saying that it'll weaken a vampire. It ended up becoming, you know, kill a vampire from this movie. And the other movie sort of picked up the ball and ran with it as well.
It's sort of become this argument that it will never go away.
Yeah.
Can a vampire be killed by sunlight or not? And it's everybody quotes, well, Stoker said this, Murnau did this.
Right.
You know, it's the origins of it. And then, of course, you get everything in between, how much are they weakened? And as a result, there's all this play from it. I watched the BBC latest version just the other day. And that was a cool interplay too on how Moffat and Gaddis decided to play with the sun on Klaus Bang. Mm-hmm, it was all in his head after all. It wasn't necessarily a physical thing, which is sort of cool.
Yeah, interesting.
I'll tell you, the one thing I do appreciate about this film, and I've said this many times on this podcast about other modern vampire tales, he's a monster. I mean, I like my vampires to be monsters. That's how it was when I was a kid growing up. And those are the best, I think, vampire stories there are. Bram captured that beautifully. I read the book, 2 years ago. I forgot just how powerful a book that it's a huge book, but you just can't get enough of it. As big of a book as it is, but it's like he was an absolute monster. Max Schreck plays this guy like a monster. You know, Murnau had him play, as he has no conscience. He has no sense of good or whatever. I mean, he comes into this town and the town literally dies. There's no happy ending to this. Yeah, you got rid of the plague, so-called plague, when Ellen tricks him into staying up longer, not getting back to his coffin before the sun hits him. But still, it's a very tragic ending where basically everybody dies. Yeah. I mean, this whole town dies.
He's the only out of the quote unquote classic monsters, which I know he's earlier than, Frankenstein's from a novel and everything. And Wolfman is from legends and all that kind of stuff. But when you look at that, Dracula's the only one that really you don't have any sympathy for in terms of he's the Wolfman. You feel sorry. Some innocent guy is now transformed into Wolf. Frankenstein monster didn't ask for a situation, gets deserted by the man who created him the night he created him and then was reviled. I mean, there's all that. Even the mummy's got, I love this woman centuries ago and I want to, there's all that. But with Dracula, he really is like, and I always called him, and I don't know, Dacre, you correct me if I'm wrong. I always kind of consider him to be sort of an emissary from hell.
That's what I believe that. And that's one of my major theories when I've looked at Bram's original research, is he was looking for a devil incarnate.
Yeah,
he had Henry Irving as Mephistopheles as his image. The books that he looked at in the London Library, it was all these devilish gods in the bowels of the earth and the volcanoes. Vlad the Impaler, who he chose to use his name Dracula, was referenced in the two books that he saw as the devil. So, Mark, I think you're absolutely spot on. Mm-hmm. And what I would have to say is this was the origin. And Orlok is as close to the origin as Bram made it. And then years later, screenwriters and directors and producers and authors have decided to let's humanize this creature and give him these backstories. Let's make him sympathetic so he's more interesting. And you know what? I can go with that, because if you didn't, would we be at 125 years right now of Dracula? And still be thinking about him and discussing the different iterations, as opposed to the one that we've all stuck with, we probably maybe 50 years ago, we would have got tired with, rather than all the different versions and the subtle incarnations that we have come to love and debate about.
Yeah, for sure.
I have a real hard time seeing Dracula as a Byron-esque figure, you know, as a romantic figure. That's a tough, I mean, you know, now Lincella sort of brought that into his iteration, but not really, or he was still a monster. But he used it as a way to get what he wanted. You know, it was more of a way to seduce his victims into his grasp.
Yeah.
But right. Some of these other iterations I really have trouble with. I mean, I'd be the first to admit it. It's like women falling in love with vampires. It's like, no, that's not a good thing to do, gals. No, you don't want to do that.
But he tells them, he promises them, you'll never have to change your underwear.
That's right.
That's true.
Unlike Mark Maddox.
I've changed it 3 times during this podcast.
Yeah, it's a good thing we only use the audio from these recordings.
Oh, brother. These are jokes, people. These are jokes.
Yeah. Well, in the few minutes we have left, final thoughts, gentlemen. I mean, this is one of the, you know, this film has made top 100 lists from every film society I can think of. And I think it's well deserving of it. It is an amazing motion picture that was a trendsetter and still holds up, I think, after 100 years.
Let me just finish by saying, I am glad and go get Scream Magazine to see Mark's amazing cover. Go read the full article, enjoy Mark's cover. And the point is, though, I am, from the Stoker's perspective, and the rest of the family feels the same way. We're glad that Florence prevailed in the lawsuit, because it did set even a symbolic precedent for people like Maddox, myself, and Adams, who are artists, and we want to make sure our material does not get ripped off. But at the same time, thank goodness that the films did survive, and it gives people the opportunity to remaster them and to put different intertitles to bring film scores so that we music scores so we can keep enjoying this maybe for another 100 years after we're all long gone.
I'm grateful to be here today. This is the thing that's interesting to me, is we kind of picking Dacre's brain and getting stuff out of him that you got to go to the people that go into the libraries and into the vaults and do that. I'm a massive fan of David McCullough. And to talk with people like this who do everything they can to get the truth matters to me tremendously. A lot of times the truth is more interesting than the made up stuff anyway.
Absolutely.
You know, so as far as the movie, I love it. 100 years. It's amazing. It's a beautiful artistic piece. It's still in my opinion, the scariest visual vampire. It's been ripped off several times, but it's the scariest visual vampire. My father had been in Vietnam. He had seen his share of war and things like that. But the only 2 times I ever saw him sit in our living room with a pillow up just about at eye level so he could duck down if he wanted to, was The Exorcist when it first came on HBO, and Nosferatu when it came on one night on PBS.
Wow.
He's like, he was surprised that he was scared by an old silent film. And it's a creative masterpiece. I'm glad it did not mess with ultimately Bela Lugosi coming along. I bet you 99% of the people that knew the movie Dracula probably had not heard of Nosferatu. So in a way, it's almost like Dracula 31 was such a massive hit that it sort of overwhelmed what I think, what is it, Florence, her fears, because it just got, Nosferatu, nobody was talking about it at that time. And Dracula was on everybody's lips, you know? So in the end, I think I'm glad it's not dead. I'm glad it wasn't, destroyed. I'm glad it's still with us. It doesn't affect my love for the 31 Dracula or the novel. It's all good in the end. Where we're at right now, it's all good.
It's all good. Dacre, we've got to have you back for some other discussions down the road. Yeah, we sort of recreate some of our Sunday breakfasts from the conventions that we appear at. So.
Yeah.
Folks, hope you enjoyed this episode, a very special episode celebrating 100 years of Nosferatu. And we'll be back with you again with an all-new episode of Monster Attack on Monday. You have a great week, and we will see you then.
Winter is coming. Prepare with a fine cigar and listen to the Cigar Nerds Podcast. We smoke cigars and talk about movies and all kind of nerdy things. Available at CigarNerdPodcast.com. Also on the ESO Network at ESONetwork.com.
This has been a broadcast of the ESO Network. Be part of the crew and help support our shows by donating to our ESO Patreon or by shopping for the TeePublic store, which can all be found at www.esonetwork.com. The ESO Network, your station for all things geek.